say hello to a new friend on an old road. Take a two-lane trip of memories into mysteries unknown. Come along for the ride. Jim Hinckley's America. Jim Hinckley's America.
Hey, good morning, my friends. You know, a little bit of music from Joe and Woody and the boys of the road crew always, always get the morning started. Since we're going to be talking about road trips and adventures, kind of fitting. Take a listen to some of their music at roadcrew66.com. Our guest this morning is Professor Nick Gerlich. Hope you don't mind, Nick, but I often think of you as kind of a modern Indiana Jones. Your adventures in search of lost highways and neon and old theaters. I get sucked into that quite a lot.
Well, it keeps me out of trouble most of the time.
most of the time. Boy, that's an opening you can drive a truck through.
Yeah. I've had a few close calls, but for the most part, it's been successful.
What I know Route 66 was, part of your, opening, if you will. It seems like it really got you started in chasing a lot of this neon.
But yeah, that was definitely the beginning. That would have been around 2010. I think I had this latent desire to do all this exploring for many, many years. It's just that I was actively involved in long distance bicycle racing, and that pretty much consumed my life, cycling, 15, 20,000 miles a year and working and being a dad and all that just didn't leave a whole lot of time for anything else. But, as I got older, I got slower on the bike, and I decided, well, maybe it's time to just make that more of a casual pursuit, and that'll give me time to do other things, the things I've been wanting to do all these years. And so it all started in Glen Rio. I could go back to my first photo album from Route 66, and it was a cold winter day, cloudy, and so I shot in black and white purposely, and boy, it just kind of took off from there. I once I did that and explored in that old Longhorn Cafe and the First Last Motel, it's like, oh man, this is too good. I got to keep doing this.
Well, it's good you documented that, because of course, as we know, Glen Rio has it's been changed rather dramatically lately.
Yeah, it doesn't look that good anymore. I've been out there recently, and it's to the point where you shed a tear every time you go by. It's really different out there now.
Yeah, gosh darn it. I follow your adventures on Facebook, of course, and I know you've done a book or two. You worked with Udo and Ellen, a really great duo, and with photography on a book there, but I sure hope that you're planning a book about your discoveries, your adventures in search of theaters and neon signs.
Well, that will definitely be coming along. Right now, I'm writing a different kind of book based on my adventure last May. Across most of the U.S. on U.S. 64. U.S. 64 starts in your state, way up in the northeast corner, near the Four Corners, near Monument Valley, and it goes for a whole 4 miles in Arizona, and then it runs into New Mexico, and then U.S. 64 crosses the states of New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina, literally crosses them from west to east in their entirety, and then hits the Atlantic Ocean, and that's it. But it was about 2,300 miles. My purpose for doing US 64 is, well, I was 64 last year, and I figured, why not? it was I called this the When I'm 64 tour.
US 66 is not our most historic or scenic highway, but I always say it's always had the best press and publicity. And for people like you and I and other, it's the gateway drug. It gets us started in search of these two-lane adventures. I was not familiar with 64 and its cross-country trip. That's one I'm going to have to look into.
It's a great road. It's US 64 is a lot like US 66, but without all the kitsch and all that. It's understated, I guess, if you will, but it does go through some bigger cities. It goes through Tulsa. It goes through Memphis. Let's see, it goes through Raleigh, you know, so those are some pretty good sized cities, and then a whole lot of really small ones. But boy, I had a blast doing it. I felt like I was really seeing America in a very unhyped kind of way, because, you know, Route 66 does get a lot of hype and attention. If you were to create a Facebook page for US 64, you'd probably struggle to get 1,000 followers. But the biggest one for Route 66 probably has about 175,000 now. Yeah. So, yeah, the other roads don't get as much press.
No, Route 66 is, it's kind of like America's longest theme park. And America's small town all rolled into one. But the problem I find with a lot of the older highways now, especially in the rural areas, is a lot of the small towns have just, they've just died. If it wasn't for a dollar store or one of those, there wouldn't be hardly anything left in some of these places.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, I joked with people while I was doing the trip. You know, they'd ask me where I was, and I would say I was in Dollar General territory, because that's pretty much all I saw.
Yeah, I should have invested in those stores a long time ago. Yeah. Nolan Stoltz says he takes US 64 pretty much every summer.
Good. That's good. It's a great road, and I've come to meet some other people who have done the same thing. You know, there's a handful of old road enthusiasts who really seek out these old numbered roads. And it's fun to talk to them. And, you know, maybe they did it 20 years ago. But they've all experienced these things. They kind of collect these experiences of all these different numbered roads.
You know, we should start a group like Alcoholics Anonymous. Hi, I'm addicted to empty highways.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You know, one I'd recommend for you if you find yourself in the neighborhood is US 12 that cuts across southern Michigan just north of the Ohio and Indiana line.
I would love to do that. You know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and US 12, yeah, I rode my bike on it, for crying out loud. You know, that's how close I lived to it. There's a huge confluence of east-west roads right there on the south side of Chicago, because they all had to get around Lake Michigan, as it turned out. And so I that was my playground, US 12, US 6. It was great fun.
Well, US 12 across southern Michigan, I recently did that, and I was a little familiar, but it dates back to, Native American Trail. And some of the towns, one of the great discoveries I made on US 12 was there's Walker Tavern, which was built in the 1830s. But I found this little town of Jonesville, Michigan. It's one of those places that's so small, First Street is the edge of town. Mm-hmm. And apparently they had a major automobile manufacturing company there, the Deal Automobile Company. And the factory is still there, and they have a Deal automobile on the front of the city hall. Pretty interesting stuff. Did you ever do much with US 6?
I've done a lot of it across Indiana, Illinois, part of Iowa, but that's the extent of it. Well, and actually, I've driven a bunch of it out in Nevada, and what's left of it in California, because it got so seriously truncated. You know, that's that old road has probably the coolest old name, the Grand Army of the Republic Road or something like that.
Yeah,
it was 4,000 miles long originally. Now it's been truncated to I think it still goes through Lone Pine maybe, but not a whole lot further. It used to go all the way downtown LA and, you know, make it truly coast to coast.
Long Beach, California, all the way to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, originally. Yeah. That highway just intrigues the daylights out of me because it seems to go almost nowhere on purpose.
Right. It just meanders.
It misses a lot of the major cities. And when you think that this highway was built in the 20s and the 30s, why would they build it across the worst part of Nevada or over Loveland Pass in Colorado, for God's sakes?
Yeah, no kidding. They didn't seem to have a whole lot of purpose in what they were doing. But anyway, it sure left us with a lot of stuff to explore.
Yeah, your signage is intrigues me. Some of the signs that you turn up with, but it's the theaters. I find your discovery of these old theaters, and Nolan has been deep into the theaters as well. But I find your discovery of these theaters in these small, faded little towns to be an endless source of fascination.
Me too. I've come to know that you didn't need to have many people in a town to be able to support a theater like 80 to 100 years ago. I mean, I've found theaters in towns as small as 500 and 1,000 people, which blows my mind because you would never build something like that today. But they often drew people from outlying areas and stuff, and it was almost like a public commons, if you will. Everybody went to the theater, rich and poor. You could see a movie for a quarter, and it was this great fun for everybody. You got dressed up, and these theaters had elaborate marquees, and they were a source of civic pride because they were down there right on the main street, often right across from the courthouse. Yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had tracking these things down. And I wish I had fallen in love with them a little bit sooner. My fascination with the theaters has been more recent, like the last 2 or 3 years. And boy, I kicked myself because I missed a lot of good photo opportunities in earlier years, but I'm making up for it now.
You sure are. You know, I found a little place near Hannibal, Missouri, Rushville, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
If you get up that way, what an incredible little town. The newspaper has been published out of the same building since, I believe it was 1880. But the theater, I stumbled into this theater, the Princess Theater. It opened about 1916. It was one family owned until about 2020. And the last remodel was in 1930. They added the marquee. Everything inside is 1930s. The little clamshell lights over the bathrooms. The popcorn machine is from 1930. And down in the cellar, they had the original arc light projector. It was a great little find. I one of my cross country adventures.
Wow, that's great. You know, there's so much hidden history and story in the development of these theaters, like, just fireproofing. I mean, that old adage about, don't cry fire in a crowded theater or anything like that. That was a very real fear in a lot of those places because a lot did burn down, unfortunately. But mostly I'm fascinated by, what was the first movie to show there? That's a great piece of trivia if I can find that. And so I find myself spending way too much time looking at online sources. If I can find, archived issues of box office, for example, I'll dive into that. And of course, there's cinematreasures.org, which is a great crowdsourced website with lots of great information about the theaters. And yeah, you can. It's a rabbit hole. That's all I'll say.
The internet. I have to be so careful that I'll start researching. Something as like a bridge. Next thing I know, I'm down some rabbit hole, and I'm reading about a cross country trip in a Franklin automobile in 1908. I don't have a clue how I get sidetracked. I was just talking to Connie Loveland in Tucumcari recently. And they've started work to restore the Princess Theater in Tucumcari. Yeah. They started an initiative.
Yes. I don't think it has gotten started yet, but I think there is that initiative. That is a beautiful building. I really like it. And it's just right around the corner from the Odeon. It's kind of funny how in so many of these towns, well, here's Tucumcari, you know, 5,000 people once had two theaters, had a drive-in also, and it supported them all for many years. And they were, and in the case of the Odeon and this one, they were just mere feet apart, like one block max, and that's it. Yeah, they've got a little way to go on that, but I think it will be a pretty cool place whenever they're able to get it done.
Have you documented any of the African-American theaters, the segregated theaters? Have you turned up any of those?
Well, I found one in Amarillo. Actually, it wasn't segregated, but it was the opposite. It was the first one in Amarillo, the Liberty Theater, that allowed Black patrons. And it is one block south of the Herring Hotel. And by virtue of its location, let's see, it's between Pierce and Fillmore on, what would that be? Fourth Avenue. It's, you could throw a stone and hit the original Route 66 alignment through Amarillo. But yeah, they allowed Black patrons, but they had to go upstairs. You know, they couldn't sit among the white folk, but at least they could go.
It's... You and I, we came in the tail end of that. Me specifically, I spent a lot of summers on folks' farms down in Alabama and Tennessee, and still can remember the segregation of the segregated bathrooms, things of that nature as a kid down south. But it just seems so foreign today. It's just hard to believe that that's the way things were.
Well, yesterday on my Instagram post, I featured the Crystal Cafe from Greenwood, Mississippi, which was developed. Well, I can't remember who developed it initially, but it was then purchased by a couple of Greek guys in the 30s. And that's when they renamed the cafe to Crystal. And in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, they did a flip-flop. Instead of suddenly Blacks being allowed, the mayor of that town was a staunch segregationist, and basically he threatened retribution to any business that did not segregate, even though it was against federal law. And so what they wound up doing at the Crystal Cafe was they made it a club, basically, and you had to have a key, and the key cost $1, but they only sold it to white people. So it became a whites-only cafe for about a decade. And then they finally got rid of that crazy policy, or maybe they got rid of the mayor. I don't know. But can you imagine? I mean, federal law suddenly granting full privilege to everybody. But these guys said, nah, that's OK. We're just going to make this a private club. And by virtue of that, they were able to dodge everything.
You know, it's astounding. I grew up vaguely with this. I find stories still that just shock me. Some years ago, I interviewed one of the Tuskegee Airmen for an article I was writing. And he was from, I believe it was Ringgold, Georgia. And he had been wounded in combat and was home on recovery. And there was a German POW camp in town. And if he took his girl to the theater, he had to use the rear entrance and set and select balcony seats. But they would bring the German POWs in on Saturday night and use the front entrance and have the front row seats.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, that's got a... Another one that is the Native American angle with theaters that I've never, you know, given a lot of thought to until I started talking to some of the Native Americans. Herb Jeffries, and Delvin Harbor's with us this morning, and maybe he's got a little bit more on this, but there was a series of all... they billed them as an all Negro cast. Herb Jeffries filmed out at Murray's Dude Ranch off Route 66 in Apple Valley, California. Are you familiar with those films?
No, I'm not. Not at all.
I was just wondering. That opened a whole nother door for me because the Bronze Buckaroo. Herb Jeffries is kind of an interesting fella. He played with Louis Armstrong, And then he became started these all African American cast singing cowboy westerns. And then when that started to fade out, he reinvented himself as an Italian crooner.
Well, I'm looking at a screen right now. I Googled it while you were talking, and now you've given me another rabbit hole. Thanks, Jim.
No problem at all. So I just wonder what other movies were filmed with an all, you know, African American cast. That'd be another one to kind of wander down to.
Absolutely. I've, you know, since I fell in love with the theaters, I did a two-part feature story for Panhandle Magazine on just the theaters of the Texas Panhandle, which, you know, the Texas Panhandle alone, it's the top 26 counties of the state. It's the size of West Virginia. I mean, it could be its own state easily. It had a lot of theaters, and it took me two articles to write about them. And then I did a feature for New Mexico 66 magazine on the theaters of, well, Route 66 in New Mexico. And so that limited the scope to, you know, just the corridor of Route 66 plus Santa Fe, because you gotta include that too. And I was amazed at how many theaters were just along that ribbon of pavement. There were a lot.
Yeah, the theaters, of course, before television, like you said, theaters were the place. Another thing that added to their appeal, especially in the Southwest, was air conditioning.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you could go there and get out of the heat and socialize, be entertained. You could, you know, check a lot of boxes there.
Some of the theaters, I was surprised, like the L.A., oh, that L.A. theater district is that astounding along the original, near the original Western terminus of Route 66?
Yeah, that is amazing. I love walking up and down. That's Broadway there. That is just amazing. It's hard to walk. You can't walk fast because there's too many things to stop and look at.
No, gosh, that I'd like to get into some of those theaters and poke around. I really would. Yeah. I've only been in a few of them.
Yeah, I've been in a couple so far, and one is a store. I mean, it was, you know, it's an Urban Outfitters now, but they kept the theater marquee, which I thought was very smart.
Yeah, Nolan had an interesting question. He was asking about the theater in Kingman. I found a picture of a black jazz combo performing for an all-white crowd. The Kingman theaters, I got myself into something, and next time you're out here, Nick, I'll share this with you. We started developing for Kingman Main Street this narrated historic district walking tour. And the old State Theater in Kingman is being renovated as a performing arts center, been closed for many years. It gets really strange. The original State Theater was on the corner of 4th and Beale Street. It was built about 39. The other State Theater was built about 1948. But we cannot find any record that theater that was built in 1948 opened until 1963.
Wow. There's a big gap there.
Yeah, until the other theater closed. And Toby Orr, who's has a construction company here, he's been applying for the grants. He's been deep into the historic research. He belongs to the historic committee here. Can find no evidence that theater opened after it was built for over 10 years.
Wow.
And another thing that's really neat, I got to show you when you come out, is that the bow trusses in that theater came from the Kingman Army Airfield. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them, they have graffiti written on them. One of them is Kilroy was here, 1944.
That's great. I'm surprised that there's no record of this theater opening. I mean, like in the newspapers and
nothing.
Phone books.
In fact, the only thing we found was a big grand opening of the new State Theater in 1963, but the building was built in 1948.
Hmm.
The front was the front of the theater was insurance offices, mm-hmm. barber shop, but the theater itself was not opened. And I've got another one for you when you come to Kingman, Nick, that you would like. I found the original base theater for the Kingman Army Airfield. It's still here.
Wow, and where is that located?
They jacked that up and two other buildings They brought them in the Kingman and they bolted them together, the Officers Club and the theater, and they put them together as the American Legion Hall here in Kingman.
That's great. Well, it's great that it's still around.
Yeah, intact theater with seating, the stage, everything is still in place. What is one of the most unique theaters that you found in a small town travels?
Oh my, that's a tough one right there.
Well, let's put it this way: the most stylish marquee you've come across in a small town.
Well, okay, the Palace Theater in Canadian, Texas, and the theater has been restored in the modern era, and now it shows movies. They have special events in there, and I have been able to tour that theater. It's a great story. Canadian, Texas, it's one of those places you kind of have to want to go there because it's really, truly off the beaten path. But speaking of paths, it was on the Dallas to Denver highway more than a century ago. So it used to be on a well-traveled road. It's on US 83 today, which does get a fair amount of truck traffic going up the midsection of the country. But otherwise, just for regular folks in cars, it's out of the way. It's about 100 miles northeast of Amarillo. You're pretty close to Oklahoma at that point. It's actually a pretty nice town. I hate to say there's money there, but I guess there is. I mean, it's a well-preserved town, and it's a lovely place to visit. And they also saved the long truss bridge over the Canadian River when they built a new highway and a new bridge. And now that old bridge is a walking path. And last fall, when I was out photographing all the theaters of the Texas Panhandle, I made sure I got out and walked it a couple of times just to have fun. It was truly amazing to go across this long bridge. It's more than half a mile across it. The river's not that big, but the arroyo or whatever the basin where the river flows through is pretty wide at that point. And it's a great town to visit, and the Palace Theater is a true gem.
I will have to look into that Canadian, Texas.
Yeah.
I was really surprised. You even got up exploring the Great Plains of Canada a while back.
Oh yeah, two summers ago. Man, that was so fun. I've been to Vancouver, in BC. I've been to Montreal, Toronto, all the stuff in the east. And I had never been to the prairie provinces. And so I made it a neon sign trip getting to Canada. And then in Canada, I didn't find that many neon signs there, maybe 15 or 20. But I went to Winnipeg, spent a couple nights there, which is just a lovely town. And then made my way west to Saskatoon. Oh, I spent the night in Moosomin, which is a neat little town. And to be honest, I was actually checking some more boxes because I've got all these old songs playing forever in my head. The Guess Who is originally out of Winnipeg. And one of their songs that was only recorded on a live album, never made it to a regular album, was called Running Back to Saskatoon. And so they name a lot of the cities out there. And so I made it part of my plan to go to as many of those cities as I could. So I spent the night in Moosomin, which is not much of a town, believe me, but it was great fun. And then went to Saskatoon and then turned south and went to Moose Jaw, spent the night in Regina, and then dropped back down into northern Montana. And then I continued the trip and drove US 2 across the whole state, which is no small task in itself because Montana is huge.
Did you find that some of the old prairie towns in Canada have the theaters? Was it comparable to what we have down here in the plains?
Not as much so. I don't think so. The thing that I found most compelling from a historical perspective and also that of a photographer is the old grain elevators. Oh, they've got so many of the old wooden, skinny, tall grain elevators there. Some of them have been clad in tin sheeting, which helps preserve them. But there's Facebook pages dedicated just to the grain elevators of the prairie provinces. And it's just breathtaking because you can see these things out on the prairies for 10, 15 miles. And all you have to do is just aim and get out and go photograph them. They are truly amazing. But just like neon signs, they ain't making any new old grain elevators anymore. And unfortunately, sometimes they come down, they fall down, vandals set them on fire. So there's, it's a finite number of these things, and people are out busy trying to document as many as they can while they still can.
That's, you know, I was curious about the differences between the communities. I saw some of your photos and they were very stark. The grain elevators there on the plains, just really stark.
It's a different kind of life living that far north. I mean, it takes really hardy people, obviously. I came across, this would be in Saskatchewan, Ukrainian communities. I mean, I found Ukrainian Orthodox churches, Ukrainian groceries, and I had to do a little Googling there to find out, oh yeah, a lot of Ukrainian people settled there. And they maintain their traditions from religion to food.
I find that kind of these little rural pockets of immigrants very fascinating. Yukon, Oklahoma, I guess, has one of the largest Czech festivals outside of the Czech Republic.
Wow, I had no idea. I didn't know they settled in Oklahoma. I'm familiar with the Czech influence down in South Texas, which is also pretty big.
One of the most intriguing things I found with it, or here in the States, as far as a rural pocket, was Maytown, Maye, Maytown, Illinois, south of Cahokia. The town was, it's beautiful. It's all stone buildings, stone bridges from the 1850s and 60s. But the town was so German that all the town records, all the town business, the town church services were all done in German into the 1940s.
That's amazing. I'm looking at it on the map here. I've not been there.
Yeah, that is a very, very fascinating town. You know, the theaters, they turn up a lot in these small towns, were very nondescript. The theater in Oatman is still there, but it's... been, of course, repurposed, but it's not something that's going to be very noticeable. It was just a real nondescript theater.
You're right, and I've discovered some like that too, even out here in the Texas Panhandle. And yeah, some of them had very spectacular signage and marquees and so forth, and others, man, not so much.
What are your plans here for this year, Nick?
That's a good question. I'm trying to figure it out myself. There will be a plan and there will be places to go. I haven't figured it out yet. I'll tell you what I want to do ultimately, maybe next year, before I get too old. I want to walk a Camino in Spain. I want to follow, you know, I want to do, it's a pilgrimage route, basically.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of people do it. I've got numerous friends who have done it. And I've been told that you don't do just one. It's addictive, like Route 66 and the old highways. But basically, you just walk long distance. I mean, the longest route is, I think, 640 miles.
Whew.
Yeah, it's a long walk. I got a buddy who's doing it right now. Yesterday was his first day. He walked 25 miles. I want to do one of those. I don't know that I'll bite off that much the first time. I would be happy with maybe, 300, half that distance. That would be good. And then there's the question of, do I carry my own, you know, wear a backpack and carry all my stuff, or do I use one of the third party tour companies that basically provide baggage shuttle and get your lodging set up for you, and then all you have to do is walk. That sounds a lot better to me, to be honest.
At our age, yes.
Yes.
I just was curious if you had plans maybe for the European Route 66 Festival this year.
No, I'm not going to be able to make that one. I know. But that sounds like it's going to be another great event. It was fun doing the one that I attended back in 2016 in Germany. That was great fun.
Nolan has a question about theaters in Amarillo. How many historic theaters do you know of in Amarillo?
There were at least 8 or 10. The bad part is there's only, I'm counting in my head here, I think 4 buildings that still exist. None of them used as a theater. And then there's the Tascosa Drive-In on the north side of town, which sadly just closed. They announced their closure at the end of summer last year. You would never know. Of those 4, you would never know that they were theaters except for one of them. That would be the Paramount. But it doesn't function as a theater. It's got a sushi bar and offices in the front. But they have the nice sign. The sign was located. It had been moved away years ago, but kept. Fortunately, it wasn't scrapped. And so they rebuilt the sign and rehung it, and it looks just stunning out there now, day and night, but it's not a theater. One of the other theaters is a church, another is a nightclub, and then there's the Liberty, which was the one that allowed black patrons, but it's just an abandoned building that doesn't look so good.
Yeah, you know, the theaters took a hard hit starting, well, really in the 60s. And then a lot of, like we said, a lot of these rural towns just have been on the slide for so many years.
Yes, I have been to about 145 cities, towns, communities, ghost towns, bumps in the road in the Texas Panhandle alone, and I've photographed all of them extensively for another project that I need to get going on, because you're right, most of these places have dried up. The Panhandle has only grown, I think, 50,000 people in the last 35 years. And it's not much, far less than what Dallas and Austin and Houston have grown, percentage wise, and definitely in terms of raw numbers. Basically, the population of the Panhandle is a lot like a colander. You can pour water in it, but it's going to go right back out. And that's been problematic. And so many of the little towns out here don't have much left. They're pretty sad.
Yeah, I drove through the Panhandle. I drove along the Kansas-Oklahoma line recently and then dropped down through the Oklahoma Panhandle and picked up Highway 54 into Tucumcari. Mm-hmm. And I was really shocked by some of those communities on how much they've dried up in the last 20 years.
Yeah. Once you leave Dalhart, you get into no man's land. I think about the only town through there is, they call it Narravaisa out here. It's, you know, butchered completely, but it's got some neat stuff in it. There's some neat stuff to photograph in that little town. An old motel, an old bar, old gas station. It's not the kind of stuff that chambers of commerce like to talk about because it's all abandonment.
Yeah. Do you find that the small cafes are still hanging on in some of these little towns, or are they disappearing too?
I think they are slowly disappearing. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that chain restaurants, fast food have just forever altered the landscape and the culture of eating, you know, in this country. That's just what people like. And I think it's kind of sad because these little small restaurants that fed people for so many years, they've lost a lot of their perceived relevance. Unfortunately, there are still plenty that exist, but I see the numbers dwindling. I have photographed many abandoned cafes.
Do you have any historic theaters down where you're at around Canyon, Texas?
Well, we have 2 buildings that used to be movie theaters. One is right across from the courthouse, and it's been shuttered for longer than I've been here, which is 35 years. I just happened to know it was a theater. And then there's the other theater right across from campus, and it only closed like in the last 5 years. It's just waiting for somebody with some money. That's a common refrain, but basically they had to close because the owner couldn't afford to go digital with his projection equipment. I mean, that was a requirement because that's how the movies are distributed now. And he couldn't afford to install all the new equipment needed just to be able to show the film, much less try to get people in there. But, you know, there are success stories out here too. If you go to Clarendon, Texas, which is Highway 287, it's the Fort Worth Highway. It took them a decade, but this community got more than $1 million together and restored the Mulkey, M-U-L-K-E-Y theater. And it is a true gem. It's got a fully functioning neon sign out front. It's bright enough to burn your retinas. It is amazing. And I've been there for a couple of gatherings of performance and also a movie, and it's great fun. It's nice to actually see what can happen. And this is a small town. Clarendon is not a big place at all. It's basically one stoplight, I think, in town, and that's it. Yeah.
It's the key is leadership, and they can inspire passion and build the network of partnerships to create a sense of community.
Right. And now they're proud of this. It's like, wow, this is our place. And they treat it as such. Yeah, and that's the way it should be. It is a source of community pride.
It's rare to find communities like that or theaters that have been put back together, like the Coleman Theater in Miami, Oklahoma. That's a really a rarity. I guess that's one reason we don't take them for granted when we find them, because they are so special.
Boy, the Coleman is amazing. I was part of a bicycle, Route 66 bicycle tour 7 years ago that went from Amarillo to Chicago. The tour director he splits Route 66 in half. And so one year he'll do the west, the other half he'll do the east, but he always uses Amarillo as the middle of the country anchor because it has an airport, you know, and you can get people in and out. But anyway, we spent the night in Miami, and he had organized and arranged for us to get to tour the Coleman and also listen to some guy play that amazing pipe organ. Oh my gosh, it is just so good. It's a really cool theater.
Yeah, that's a gem that people need to take time and get a tour of that theater. It's really special. Another theater that's really a standout for me, I like the Native American touches, is the old theater on, I think it's Cole Street in Gallup. That one has survived. It has survived changing demographics, a multiplex being built at the shopping center. Mm-hmm. Somehow it's managed to hang on, and it's got some great Native American artistry.
Yes, that would be the El Moro.
Yes, the El Moro.
Yeah, that was fun to photograph that one. That's a good one.
New Mexico has a lot of unique theaters. The Chemo in Albuquerque.
Yes. Oh boy, that is a beauty. I've seen some interesting things there. Many years ago, my friends and I went to see a burlesque show, which, you know, sounds like it would be, you know, rated R, but no, it's not. It was actually tastefully done. I saw a private screening of El Camino, the movie that was a sequel to Breaking Bad. They had a special showing there. Oh, and I saw Bryan Cranston there in a performance. Actually, it was like a fireside chat between him and Bob Odenkirk. And that was fun. Got to meet Bryan Cranston and or Walter White, I should say. That was fun.
Nick, you know, I want to thank you for taking time of your schedule today for this. I've been anxious to talk to you for quite a while about your adventures because I'm a real follower of your explorations. And, the whole idea behind this is to inspire road trips by telling people where to go and sharing America's story. And this is both. This is, I was really eager to do this because this is both. You inspire road trips, and with your digging into the history of these theaters and these little towns, it's America's story. And you're really writing some great chapters for future generations.
Well, thank you.
It truly is greatly appreciated. Do you have a website with, or is it just social media, Instagram and Facebook?
I'm just doing social media now. I'm on obviously Facebook and Instagram. Those have been my mainstays for many years. That's where I post my neon signs. I post it on Instagram and it copies over to Facebook.
Right.
On Facebook, I then put some general travel pictures, and all of these are in color. And then over on Threads, which was the spinoff website from Instagram last summer, it's a social media site, a lot like Twitter. That's where I post all my black and white. And I have started focusing on just Texas and all in black and white. And so that's a whole different chapter of my photography. Somebody asked me, how come you do color and some color, some black and white? And I said, because they're different platforms and I want people to see through a different lens, basically. And so my Texas content is primarily West Texas, but I've posted some from as far south as I think Brownsville. I mean, if I like it, I'm going to post it. I render it in black and white. Sometimes I'll put some lipstick on that pig and make it look really pretty.
So put some lipstick on the hog and tell everybody it's the prom queen.
That's right. Like yesterday I posted Paisano Pete, this huge roadrunner statue in Fort Stockton, Texas. And if you ever go through Fort Stockton, you can't miss it. And you got to stop and get out and photograph it. It's just good.
Brady Wilson's asking if you could contact him. He's got some questions. He works there in Canyon, Texas as well.
Yes, absolutely. Come see me at my office. I'm in the classroom center. You can find me, and you just ask anybody, they'll know where I am. So by all means.
Because he's into doing photography, and he says he works at WT.
Yep, that's where I work. So come see me.
Yeah. Nick, again, thank you. And if you find yourself out this way, give a holler. Like I say, I've got some great things to share with you. And we're picking up the pace with getting some neon together here in Kingman. One of the latest that we've put up in Kingman, and I have mixed feelings about this, but it's just quirky enough and colorful enough. I have a feeling it's going to be quite an attraction, but Scott Dunton of the Kingman Route 66 Association, before he passed, he acquired a neon sign from a closed wedding chapel in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. and it's been repurposed to show the heart of Route 66 Kingman, Arizona, complete with Cupid. It's definitely a little bit different. I'm curious to follow the threads talking about how this is being perceived. It's kind of intriguing.
I saw it online, I think yesterday, and it looks beautiful. Next time I come to Kingman, I'll make sure to stop and admire it and photograph it.
Thank you, Nick. Hey, thanks you, Nick, for taking time on your Sunday for this. I've really enjoyed the conversation immensely. And judging by the audience that we've got here, for people from literally all over the United States, I think you probably inspired a road trip or two.
Well, you got to get out and see America while you still can. There's so much to see and to appreciate. And I'm just thankful for being able to do it and being able to share it with everybody else, because this is the kind of stuff, these are the stories that need to be shared.
You know, one more that just popped up here. You did a lot of research with Route 66 in New Mexico, the old bridges, the real old alignments, and some of the navigation arrows.
Yeah. Oh my, that's another rabbit hole. The concrete navigation arrow. Stop me if I wax poetic for too long, but I fell in love with the concrete navigation arrows about 8 years ago, maybe 10. I saw some story on CNN or someplace online about these crazy arrows in the ground and what were they and all that. And well, long story short, between 1926 and about 1932, this was the beginning of U.S. airmail. And the post office did not have its own planes or pilots. They hired individual pilots who had little airplanes. They were called, this was called contract airmail pilots, and they would hire these guys to fly, literally, this was airmail, fly from big city to big city. They had established airways, for example, like, you know, it's an airway is like a highway that you can't see, but they had routes, basically. But they didn't have any navigation. They didn't have radio. They didn't have radar. And yeah, you could always follow the Iron Compass, which is the railroad, but that didn't always work because it didn't always go where you wanted it to. And so to aid them, these concrete arrows, which are about 70 feet long, were placed on the, along these airways, the routes that they wanted them to take, about every 10 to 15 miles. And they also had a beacon tower that was, I think, 51 feet tall. So they had a red blinking light. So they could go day and night flying the mail, literally zooming across the country as fast as could be done back then. And following blinking lights at night and concrete arrows by day, they only flew about 1,000 feet above the ground. So they were able to see these arrows quite easily. So it was literally, they were breadcrumbing their way across America, if you can imagine that. And then they had an emergency runway about every two beacon towers, just in case. but they made their, you know, they made their way. And Amarillo was a hub city for mail delivery. So it was the eastern terminus of the LA to Amarillo airway. And then from here, mail either went southeast to Dallas. They also had an airway from Amarillo to Kansas City, which then they had another airway to Chicago and then another one to New York City. But once the early 30s came with the development of radio and radar, they didn't need these beacon towers and concrete arrows anymore because they had better ways of navigating and staying in touch. So they basically were obsolete. But fast forward to the early 40s, with World War II, the government didn't want to make it too easy for enemy pilots. Should that happen, you know, like the Japanese, for example, not being satisfied with Pearl Harbor, but wanting to hit the mainland, they didn't want to make it too easy for them to find their way across the country. So they destroyed a lot of the concrete arrows and the beacon towers. That was scrap metal. So that aided the war effort right there. Today, there are, I think, 126 known concrete arrows scattered across the country. I've been to, I think, 67 of them. Some of them I had to use all my wits to get to. One in New Mexico, I navigated to in a dense fog. I made a Google map where all these things are. So I was literally walking with my phone in my hand in a dense fog to get to this arrow. And of course, as soon as I got there, my phone died because I had used all my battery navigating to get to it. And so that was fun getting out of that one. That took a lot longer to find my way out of there in a fog. But yeah, these are amazing. And there are, probably 7 or 8 in New Mexico. There's none in Northern Arizona. There's a couple in California. Half of the ones in New Mexico I can't get to because they're on tribal land, and I respect that. And I really don't want to spend the night in a tribal jail. So that might not end very well. So until I can make friends on reservations and get them to accompany me, those are just going to have to reside on my wish list. But I've been to 5 in Kansas on that airway, and there's one in Northwest Oklahoma as well that's on that airway, and those were easy to get to.
And this goes full circle. This is why I reference you a lot as the Indiana Jones of these adventures. That's exactly. Yeah. Well, that opens the door for a whole other conversation sometime. We've got to talk about airways, because then I can talk to you about some of the things I've been discovering with Western Air Express.
Oh my.
One of the pioneering freight and passenger companies in the mid-1920s here in the Southwest. And I have located a terminal site, a few other things here.
It's great fun. Hey, I just finished an article on the history of Amarillo Aviation. It's going to come out in Brick and Elm magazine here in Amarillo next month. And boy, I learned so much doing that. I had no idea. I've just lived here 35 years, but I didn't know anything.
I love that. Hey, my friends, thank you. Nick, God bless. Thank you for doing this today. And for everybody who joined us, I want to thank them. And if you need a base camp for exploring, there's lots of them along Route 66 and other places. Two of my favorites, of course, is the Wagon Wheel Motel in Cuba. And I really can't say enough about David Brenner and the Roadrunner Lodge in Tucumcari. And Angela Moreland at the Cactus Inn Motel in McLean, Texas. She's doing some just pretty amazing things, not only with her motel, but breathing some life into little McLean. And if you have trouble, you're kind of nervous about planning a great road trip, talk to the folks at Route Trip USA. These guys are really specialist in putting together a custom, bespoke road trip for you in the United States or Canada. Mr. Nick, thank you so very much. And I do look forward to our next visit and see you next time our paths will cross. We're overdue for a sit down with some beer. And as often as you can tell, folks, when Nick and I get together, we can just be at our gums for hours.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, I greatly appreciate it. Next week, we're going to talk to the owners of the Pink Elephant in Livingston. Livingston, Illinois, Roy Pickrell. And then we got Ron Romero coming up with the Rock and Roll Museum, Route 66 Museum in Joliet. And after that, on March 10th, we'll be talking to Scott Piotrowski. He's got some exciting news about Route 66 in California. He is the president of the California Route 66 Association. And then, we've got the Brandon Oliver, the good folks at the Texas Route 66 Visitor Center in Amarillo, coming up on March 17th. And that'll be followed by mural artist Ray Harvey, who is well-known in Missouri for his murals. And I'm quite pleased to say he's taking the show on the road, going to be doing some murals here in Kingman on a westward adventure. All fun stuff. Well, until we meet again, my friends, we will bid you adios. And we've got a new video up on our Jim Hinckley's America YouTube channel. Tell me what you think. In Search of Lost Highways, Episode 5 is now up. Well, Nick and my friends, until we meet again, we'll bid you adios with a little bit of music from Joe and Woody and the Boys of the Road Crew. Adios, Nick.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Say hello to a new friend.
Thank you for everybody who joined us today. And I want to give a shout out to Chris Tuttle with Arizona Podcast. You might want to check out not only the podcast, but he's got a great YouTube channel he's putting together.
Jimmy.
All things you want to take a look at to inspire a road trip or two.
Jim Hinckley's America.
Adios, amigos.